Six Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Corey Taylor.
I push my fingers into my eyes. It's the only thing that slowly stops the ache. But it's made of all the things I have to take.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to a brand new series of The First Time, the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at some of the pivotal first moments that made their lives and careers. This week, I'm talking to the frontman of one of the most musically aggressive and visually terrifying groups ever. They're a band who've assaulted the senses of audiences all around the world with their chaotic live shows since they formed in 1995. Our guest today joined in 1996 and led them to become one of the most successful metal groups of their generation, selling over 30 million albums worldwide. I'm very pleased to say that this week my guest on the first time is Slipknot's Corey Taylor. Slipknot continue to dominate huge stages and rock festivals all around the world, and their masked image and provocative, often nihilistic attitude has earned them a certain reputation, especially in the US. But Corey is something of a metal renaissance man. He also fronts the rock band Stone Sour. He's a solo artist. He's authored several successful novels. He's got a film career. He's collaborated with people like Dave Grohl, and he's been a campaigner for mental health and substance abuse charities. In this interview, we peel back the mask as Corey talks about his turbulent early life growing up in a trailer in the Midwest of America, the moment he decided to join the world's most nightmare-inducing band, his battles with addiction, and deep love for the music of Faith No More, Prince, Public Enemy, and maybe surprisingly, Ray LaMontagne. But I started by asking Corey, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music as a child?
The first time I can really remember music was hanging out at my grandma's house and listening to Elvis. Train a ride.
16 coaches long. That's a good start.
Yeah, man, it's not bad, right? I mean, it's and she had stacks of vinyl and 8-tracks and stuff like that. So it seemed like there was always music going on. She was always playing records, whether it was Elvis or, and this takes some people back, Jim Reeves, the Statler Brothers.
Nice.
I keep hearing you're concerned about my happiness. But all that thought you're giving me is conscience, I guess. If I were walking in your shoes, I wouldn't worry none. While you and your friends are worried about me, I'm having lots of fun. Counting flowers on the wall, that don't bother me at all.
My mom had a bunch of stuff from when she was a kid as well, like early British beat wave kind of stuff, like kind of knockoff stuff that you'd find in like a bargain bin. It's like, well, if you like the Beatles, you like the Beats, you know? And it was like, what? And then it was basically, they were just playing all the Beatles standards, but you could definitely tell that it wasn't the Beatles, you know? And so it was rad, you know? Like there was a ton of, I just remember just being surrounded by not only music, but audio, you know? Whether it was comedy albums, or like long playing LPs, or you had, like my mom had a stack of 45s that I would dig through all the time.
Playing solitaire till dawn.
Growing up in my grandma's house off and on was basically the catalyst for all of the gnarly music that I end up listening to.
What about the first single or album or thing that you owned yourself that was yours, that you cherished? What was that?
That I went out and bought with on my own money?
Yeah, that you bought, borrowed, or stole that was yours.
Dude, once again, I'm going to date myself. It was the 598 EP. It was Garage Days, Revisited. I walked to the local mall and bought it. I barely had enough. And the dude spotted me like 3 cents, I want to say. And it was like, he's like, dude, I totally know. I was like, I've been wanting to buy this myself. And I walked, I didn't even have headphones. I didn't have a Walkman. I just had, you know, I stared at it all the way home, walked with it. It's like, I don't know, I've never even heard of these songs. Like, what are these? Like, I had no idea what it was. And I put it on, and I played that thing so much that I wore off the text. Let's put it that way. For those listening at home, it was the original Garage Days Metallica album, where it was basically an EP, and they played everything from Killing Joke to Misfits. It was such a great blending of metal and punk for me, because those were two of my favorite styles.
We'll be right back. Why metal for you? What was it that chimed in you, that resonated when maybe other kind of music didn't?
Oh, it was definitely the anger.
Okay.
Listen, I've got so many strikes against me in the anger issues like department. I'm German-Irish. I grew up poor. I grew up in a trailer. I grew up redheaded and pale. Nobody liked me, you know? And I also grew up in like gnarly environments, you know, like my childhood just wasn't the best. So I grew up with a lot of scathing issues that were just kind of bubbling to the surface. Luckily, I had this urge for music that was certainly filled by things like Metallica, Iron Maiden, Slayer, like on the metal side. You know, obviously on the punk side, there was Minor Threat and Black Flag and stuff, but on the metal side, it was definitely stuff like that.
Yeah, because it's been really well documented. You had really, really tough teenage years. I mean, I was kind of taken aback the more I kind of found out more about it. Addiction and homelessness and overdoses and suicide attempts. And I'm going to do some name dropping. When we had Elton John on this show and he talked about his own, when he was deep in depression and deep in drink, he said like it was his love for music was like literally the only thing that made him feel better. The only thing. Was that the same for you?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, there are two kinds of people in this world. There are people who put music on in the background, and there are people who put life in the background when music is playing. And I am very much the latter. People are like, don't you have any earbuds? I'm like, no, I'm not trying to listen to music on speakers that are the size of the head of a pin, for goodness sakes. I'm like, are you serious? I want to feel my music. There were times at my all-time lowest, like all through my life, that music came in and saved me, man. It gave me something to cling on. It was the anchor in this world that was, to me at the time, from a very selfish point of view, was trying to beat me down, you know? Mm. And whether it was music that kept me going or my own will to just not lose, you know, didn't have to win. I just didn't want to lose. That was the thing that really kept me sane, you know, that people that were out there could understand the way I felt. The people out there that could do something that I desperately wanted to do, which was make music, and do it in a way that could touch other people. And one of the reasons why I've injected so much of myself into my music is because the people I grew up listening to did the same thing, man. Like this was not a weekend gig for them. This was live or die.
Yeah. You had a bit of a Faith No More inspiration moment, didn't you? The heavens kind of opened and Faith No More had a big impact.
Yes.
Because I saw that band a lot the first time around, because we were about the same age.
Right.
And I remember just being stunned. And then they reformed and I was stunned again. It was kind of cool.
Dude, I tell you what, you talk about the reformation. I remember when they headlined Download and they came out playing Reunited.
Yep, all in the pastel suits.
Oh.
Reunited and it feels so
dude, I've chills. I have chills right now. Like, it was so amazing. And then for them to go from Reunited into The Real Thing, I lost my mind. I was like, I'm so angry at you for being amazing. Like, I was,
Reunited, hey, hey.
It was a moment laying on my couch at my grandma's house, actually. It seemed like the catalyst for everything was my grandma's house. And unfortunately, I had just come back from the hospital because I was the last time I tried to commit suicide. Let's put it that way. My ex-girlfriend's mom just happened to stop at my house to check on me, found me on the floor, called the ambulance. They rushed me to the hospital. Then there was an awkward moment with my grandmother where she picked me up and drove me home. The coldest silence because she was so heartbroken that I had tried to do something like that, you know? She went into her room, I laid on the couch, and it was the VMAs, man. It was the VMAs where Faith No More was playing Epic, and they just didn't care, dude. They didn't care, and it was amazing. I sat up, and I realized that there were no rules, man. And that got me back into looking at music as a way for me to let go of these things that I'd just been kind of sitting on for a long time, you know?
Can you feel it? See it? Hear it today. If you can't, then it doesn't matter anyway. You will never understand it because it happens too fast. And it feels so good inside, walking the glass.
Let's talk about Prince. When did Prince first come into your life? When did you get the love for his royal purpleness, his royal late great purpleness?
His purple badness. He was a legend in the Midwest, man. He's from Minnesota. He's from Minneapolis.
Course, yeah, of course he is.
So as a kid from Des Moines, Iowa, you know, like I was like, whoa, he made it from here? Like, that's only 3 hours from my house, you know? Like, I thought that was amazing. And not only was he just incredibly talented, he was just such an amazing songwriter. And I became very aware of Prince on the 1999 album. Because right around the same time that I was really invested in the early days of MTV. So all of those videos were coming on. Like, a lot of the stuff from Controversy was coming up. Mm-hmm. I think there was a video for Dirty Mind on there.
Yes.
And where I was like, dude, he's wearing panties. Like, what's happening here? You know, because I discovered Prince before I discovered Rick James. Let's put it that way. But that, again, that's another deep dive that was worth it because, you know, Prince showed me that you could marry all of these different types of music together. He had rock, R&B, there was soul, there was gospel, there was funk, there was disco, there was all these great, really amazing elements. It wasn't just for show. It was wrapped around a mind that could write a song just at will, you know? So it was really with Purple Rain that my love for Prince really exploded. And Let's Go Crazy was just such an epic song. Still is. You know, you listen to it and you're like, you don't even know where this is going to go. It's riffy. It's funky. It's poppy. I'm like, it's not fair how good it is. You're just like, really? To this day, it's probably one of my favorite pop songs, man.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else. The afterworld. A world of never-ending happiness. You can always see the sun. Day or night. So when you call up that shrink in Beverly Hills, you know the one. Doctor, I think it'll be alright.
let's do another first. What was your very first band like? Because, you know, most people's first band has to have a pretty bad name.
Oh, yeah.
B, the drummer has to be in the band only because he's got a van. That's the rule. And you've got to be pretty awful. What was your first band like?
My first band wasn't really even a band, but maybe we were ahead of our time where it was only two people. So I was the drummer and the singer, and my buddy Ben Callahan was the guitar player. Neither of us were very good. Like, not really, not that great, but our name was amazing.
Go on.
It was Bloodfest.
Yes.
First of all, none of the music we wrote was even remotely Bloodfest like. I mean, it was, we were really impressed with playing 12 bar blues basically over and over and over and just kind of singing whatever, because we were like, you know, metal kids. You know, we were just like, well, dude, I mean, our name just has to be violent, man. Like, it's gotta have some heart to it. And I think I was the one who said, well, what if it was Blood Feast? And Ben said, what about Blood Fest? And I was like, yeah, that's amazing. We were not amazing. Not even part of it was amazing.
We're jumping about a lot here, but I was going to ask you about the first Slipknot rehearsal, but what was your first impression of them as people?
You know, the crazy thing about Slipknot is I knew all those dudes because they were all in bands that were playing in Des Moines, you know? Like, we were all a part of the scene, and we had been a part of the scene for so many years. I knew Joey. Mm-hmm. I knew Josh Brainerd, who's the original guitar player. I'd known Mick from going to the bar and stuff. I knew Craig because he was in a band with Josh and Joey. I didn't know Clown, but I got to know him after Slipknot had played their first show. And I was actually at that very first show. And I've told this story like so many times, like watching them play was so volatile. It was terrifying, to be honest, because it was so intimidating, you know? Like, they all had masks. The coveralls hadn't come around yet, but they were all dressed freaky, like super freaky, dude. And they were in your face. Get out of my head, 'cause I don't need this. Why didn't I say this? Violent bursts of like blast beats and grinding and then the percussions. And I can remember watching this and being so affected by it. And I just, for some reason, I just thought to myself, I was like, I'm going to be the singer in this band.
Is that true? Because that's the kind of legend is like, yes.
Dude, I was right in front. There were only about, I want to say about 100 people there. You know, it was a small club, and it just kind of happened. They were opening for a band from out of town, and it just happened, you know? And it was so good, I immediately asked them to play with Stone Sour the next night, because we were playing the same club, and they were all about it. They were totally down. So it was crazy. Like, the first two Slipknot shows I was at, and one of them I was playing with the other band that they had then asked me to leave to join Slipknot. It was so incestuous, man. It was so ridiculous. But I swear to God, I had that feeling. I was like, and I've never had that feeling since. Like, I was like, I'm gonna be the singer for this band. But I knew that I loved it. I knew that there was something about it that brought something out of me. And the rest is history.
That was a blast of Slipknot's first ever single, Wait and Bleed, released in 1999. And this is The First Time with the band's Corey Taylor. And we'll have more from our chat after the Six Music News.
Six Music.
This is BBC Radio.
Six Music.
BBC News at 1:30. I'm Claire Runacres. The Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, has insisted there is more support for the economy to come in his budget on Wednesday, including a new fund to help the hospitality and high street sectors in England. 700,000 firms will be able to apply for up to £18,000 each to help them reopen. But Sonia Khan, who was an advisor to the former Chancellor Sajid Javid, says one-off payments will not satisfy many struggling businesses.
Really, it feels like it plugs a short hole now, but it doesn't provide certainty for the future. And where the anxiety is for most people and for most businesses is not knowing what the long-term future looks like. So actually, where will we be? Not just 6 months, but a year, 2 years down the line.
At least 9 people are reported to have been killed in Myanmar in the bloodiest day since protests began against the military coup. Police opened fire in at least 3 cities. The authorities in Hong Kong have charged 47 opposition activists in the largest single use of the controversial national security law imposed by Beijing last year. The EU has called for their immediate release. The actor Johnny Briggs, who played Mike Baldwin in Coronation Street, has died, aged 85. He appeared in the soap for 30 years after joining in 1976. A Coronation Street scriptwriter, Damon Rochefort, says a love rivalry storyline involving Mike Baldwin and Ken Barlow will always be a highlight for fans.
I mean, it was sweeping the nation. In fact, I think I'm right in saying Manchester United or City or one of them actually flashed up on their boards at the game, you know, Deirdre stays with Ken. I mean, incredible.
Police say it's still not safe for some people to return to their homes in Exeter after thousands of properties were evacuated to allow the detonation of a Second World War bomb. Yesterday's blast damaged a number of buildings. And a Californian plastic surgeon is being investigated after he attended a virtual court hearing while operating on a patient. Dr. Scott Green was facing alleged driving offences. That's 6 Music News, more at 2:30.
This is BBC Radio 6
Music. Listen to 6 Music anywhere on the BBC Sounds app.
Still in time.
Welcome back. I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time with Corey Taylor, frontman of Slipknot and Stone Sour. And that was Slipknot with Before I Forget from their 2004 album, Volume 3, The Subliminal Verses. Even after that very first Slipknot album, it happened big and it happened quickly. When did you first feel famous? Do you think you were good at it?
I don't know. To be honest, I mean, dude, we weren't expecting this. In the past, we've been like, oh, yeah, it was all part of the plan. No, it wasn't. Dude, how was the hardest road there part of the plan? Because think about it. We were 9 metal dudes in masks and coveralls from Iowa playing insanely brutal music. On paper, that math doesn't work, you know, especially when it comes to like fame. But for some reason, we just touched a nerve. We touched something, man. And maybe it was because that music came from our own wants to hear music like that. And that, you know, it was just like, you know, it's somebody, you know, nobody's writing it, so let's just make it ourselves. Maybe it was because of that that people really gravitated towards us. And the fact that we had such a visceral message of pull your idols down and show them what you want instead of just killing them.
But in terms of you, I mean, in terms of it's, there's some lovely things that go along with that level of success. The catering's pretty good. But there's an attention, there's expectation, there's pressure. And some people are good at that. Some people aren't so good at that. Some people, and I think this might be the case with you, learn to get good at it. But when it first happened, that kind of whirlwind, it's like, all right, okay.
You know, the first year and a half that we toured on that first album was absolutely chaotic because all we did was put our heads down and charge forward. Mm. The only thing we cared about was the work. The only thing we cared about was breaking through, you know, especially once the success started to happen. Once the album went gold, then went platinum, then went double platinum, we were just like, what? So we just kind of went for it, you know? It seemed like we were always on the road. We were touring the world before we knew how to. And for the most part, we stuck together through all of it. Obviously, we had our ups and downs, but we stayed fairly sober and really tried to capitalize on it. It wasn't until the second album, mm-hmm. when we kind of took a second to catch our breaths, that it all kind of started to pull apart for whatever reason. I mean, obviously, my demons started to come out. You know, my addictive personality just was like, okay, well, let's just get bombed all the time, you know? So, you know, from that standpoint, I went into a really gnarly, dark place that I didn't come out of for probably about 5 years. Mm-hmm. And once I did, I realized that I had not only missed a lot in the conception of not only that second album, but also my first Stone Sour album, and a lot leading up into mm-hmm. Volume 3. But I'd missed a lot of life, man. You know, like I was pretty unavailable for the first year of my son's life. Which, you know, I mean, that was a little of my fault, a little of my ex-wife's fault, a little, like, just there was just a lot. We were young. We were all young, didn't really know how to handle anything, man. And it wasn't until I came up for air that I realized, it's like, man, I can't do this. This isn't what I want. Well, what did I want? What I wanted was to make music, to be a dad, and to just be able to, you know, catch my breath and enjoy it. And once I did that, I mean, it was a very long road and it took some trial and error, but it was, you know, once I did that, I really rededicated myself to being available and being aware. And from that second on, me and my son were inseparable. We were, you know, we were peas in a pod, and we still are.
What was the first sober show like? Because I've spoken to musicians who've been through this, and they all say the same thing. They all say, first show was awful, but I would not change it because now it's different and it's better than it ever was. But I had to go through how awful it was.
Right, right. I don't know if it was awful, to be honest, because I wasn't even really concerned about it because I'd had time to be sober.
Yeah.
There were other things to worry about other than the live show for me. Mm-hmm. And I knew that everything was going to be fine, because it was one of the things that I loved to do. It was only really the booze that got in the way, you know? So once I let that go, I realized that I could enjoy the shows even more, you know? Like, it was like there was nothing bogging me down. I wasn't you know, I wasn't weighed down with booze and chemicals and everything else. It was just me being in that moment. And I'm, you know, being a singer, there's a little bit of a, you know, a selfish ego. And I realized it's like, hey, there's nothing that's muting or dumbing down this experience for me. So I was fine, man. You know, the booze wasn't even about fear of being on stage. It was just about being loaded. Mm. So I've always been a performer and I've never had an issue being on stage. So I can just remember enjoying it. I didn't even really worry about it, to be honest.
Let's do another tune. Public Enemy. If you want to talk about a band that doesn't sound like anything else, fight the power. Come on.
Dude, first of all, I mean, everything I learned about politics, I learned from Public Enemy. Listening to Chuck, first of all, who I've had the privilege and pleasure of meeting, is one of the sweetest men I've ever met. He's also one of the smartest men I've ever met. Like, I was like a blubbering fanboy in front of him. And he calmed me down enough that we could actually have a real conversation, you know? The great thing about Public Enemy is that it's alive. That music is alive because there's still the same issues going on today that were going on 30 years ago when that album came out, and which is sad in a lot of ways. You know, the fact that it feels like for every, you know, 4 feet you drive forward, you get driven back 5 feet, you know? Just understanding civil rights and the way that in America, especially, certain things are set up in certain ways, depending on what region of the country you're in, you definitely understand that geopolitical issues are going on, you know? So knowing that, and also, you know, coming from a punk background, which is very political, and the fact that hip hop was very much on that same kind of punk mindset coming from the streets of New York, it made so much sense that Public Enemy became one of my favorite, you know, hip hop groups. Chuck D's lyrics are so concise. His flow is so effortless that you just gravitate towards it. And you get pulled into what he's saying, even if you don't immediately understand what he's saying, man. And because of that, because his voice is just so confrontational and yet soothing at the same time, and he doesn't get lost in the anger. The message doesn't get weighed down in the anger. It's still so intelligent. You know, I can put that album on today or 10 years ago or 10 years before that and still feel it just as vehemently as you did the first time you hear it, man. It's just that strong a song.
Fight the power.
I was going to ask you about Motley Crue, but instead I'm going to ask you about Ray LaMontagne. Because nothing wrong with Motley Crue, but it's your taste is really broad. It's kind of been like the more you talk and the more you kind of put yourself out there, it's been really interesting to sort of see you champion all kinds of different sorts of things.
One of the things that drives me nuts about music and the way people listen to it is they feel like they can only listen to one type, you know, like, and I don't know if that's because of the way that the music industry is set up in certain countries or whatever, where you're almost coached to just like one style of music. And it almost sets up an inherent distaste for anything that's not like that. Whereas when I was growing up, I didn't even subscribe to any of that. I just kind of went with where my heart went. So my style, my musical taste never really formed one way or another. I just knew the stuff that I liked. So I've always kind of gone with that. And when I heard Ray LaMontagne's first album, Trouble, I mean, I was transfixed. Some of the best songwriting I've ever heard, some of the best lyrics I've ever heard. I mean, to the point where I was so jealous. Like, stuff that's just so good that get mad that you didn't write it, you know? Like, that's the kind of stuff Jolene alone is worth buying that album for.
Jolene.
There's such a great blend of Otis Redding, Neil Young, and the Eagles with him that you find yourself kind of sinking in and listening to it going, dude, where has this guy been all my life? And it's, to this day, I mean, my favorite album from top to bottom.
I also like the fact that he seems completely unbothered by the whole public-facing bit of being a musician. He's just, I'll just do it. I don't need to talk to anyone about it. I'll just get on with it, which I quite admire.
It's beautiful, man. Like, I love that. Like, he's just like, whatever, you know. I'll promote this for the people who want to hear it, and for those who don't, right, it's fine. Don't bother yourself. That's amazing. Like, I love that, you know. And it's kind of, it's almost the thing that I'm doing right now, where I'm just like, it's like I'm promoting stuff, but I'm like, look, I'm not gonna beg you. I'm not gonna beg you to listen to my music. You're either into it or you're not. If you're not, you're lost, dude. My bad.
You know me better than the ones who know me best. I know that there's no other way. I know that there is nothing more that I can say. Paint my black eyes blue. I'm all for you.
Tell me a bit about the first moment before you walk on stage, because it's a really interesting contract between a band and an audience, for all bands at any level. I'm not just talking about big acts. There's that moment when you're like, even if the set list is the same, the gig will be completely different.
Right, right.
You could have played the same venue before, the gig's going to be completely different. How do you feel just before that first song starts?
It all depends on if I'm sick or not. When I feel great, there is nothing that can keep me from getting on that stage and going early if I can. Like, I just, I love it. I love to perform. I love entertaining people. So you can imagine what this year has been like for me.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, when I'm well and I'm really feeling it, I could honestly pull my own head off and kick it in the audience, and I'd be completely okay with it. I'd be like, yep, that was exactly what needed to happen in that moment. When I'm sick, I stress out really hard because I know I'm not going to be able to perform to the best of my abilities. Like, it really bums me out. Like, and I'm not a person who likes to cancel. I've only canceled 4 shows in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, it was only because I couldn't produce a noise from my throat. When this is such a part of your blood and a part of your soul, of course you just want to be out there. You want the show to go longer. My whole goal in life, especially with my solo career, is to be a sort of harder-edged Bruce Springsteen. I want people to come and see me play and go, God, it was a different show than the last time we saw him.
Mm-hmm.
How does he do it? You know, like, that's what I want, because that's how much it means to me, man.
Let's do Megadeth.
Oh, yeah.
When's the love first start there, then?
You know, honestly, Metallica begat Megadeth for me. You know, it was while I was kind of discovering the whole history and mythology of Metallica that I realized that Megadeth was a thing. I realized that Dave had been a member. He had been ceremonially dismissed, I guess is the nice way to put it.
It's the political way of putting it.
Right. And then kind of went on to create his own thing. And I just remember being blown away by the musicianship, you know? I mean, a lot of people rarely talk about just how good Dave Mustaine is. They always get bogged down in the drama. First of all, he is a riff specialist. I mean, the stuff he writes, like, even just coming from a standpoint of trying to learn how to play some of that stuff, I just go, nope, can't, nuh-uh, nope, yeah, I don't know what he just did there, but he just basically crossed his fingers in the middle of a riff, and I don't know how you do that. I do not know how you do that and play it and still do it with, like, that kind of attack. Like, it's ridiculous, man. And, you know, and not only that, but his first 4 albums, 5 albums, are incredible. To be honest, my favorite is So Far, So Good, So What, because it is so grungy and dirty sounding, and like, the production is awful, and yet it's so in your face. It's so volatile, so chock full of attitude, that I'd be hard pressed for anyone to say that that's not one of their heaviest albums. Not just from a technical standpoint, but just from an anger standpoint. And Liar, that song, oh my God, that was the one that really hooked me in, because it's so catchy. I'm just like, it's so weird. Like, it's like, bam, 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 bam. I'm like, where do you even start with that? That's not on the 1. It's not even on the 3. I don't know where that goes. And to this day, I still don't know how to play that riff. And then the crazy, weird machine gun lyrics. Where it's like, start, panic, spread, paint, then, you're just like, what is that? That's rad, dude. Like, it's so, so cool.
So what's next? I mean, you know, you've been talking about a solo record for about, you know, or thinking about it for about 10 years, and you've knocked it out in a few weeks, and that's here. So what's on the whiteboard of your mind? What's, like, must get round to doing?
I mean, musically, I want to continue to do, because I've got, like, 3 more solo albums written that I could put out.
Finished?
Oh, yeah.
Written.
Yeah, written, finished, like, done. And I'm constantly writing as well.
Triple album, mate, triple album.
Oh, no, I wouldn't punish people like that. Like, I couldn't do it. You know, I had, it was hard enough doing the double House of Golden Bones albums.
Yeah.
I mean, trying to record all that stuff in one session was torture. Like, as much as I loved it and it creatively, it really came off. I wouldn't do that to people that I care about again, because it was just so, it was just so like strenuous, and like people ended up not enjoying the process, even though the end result was great. But I will say with this, man, it's so much fun that just, we can knock out 14 songs in 2.5 weeks. I mean, we're that good. We record everything live, so you just feel it, you know? I'm looking to get together with the Slipknot guys and make a new Slipknot album in the very near future. Hopefully tour on all this stuff once the plague goes away, whenever that happens. Creatively speaking, I'm actually getting into screenplays and working and writing movies. Yeah, I'm in a sort of pre-production stage right now with some people who are going to help me get it made. And it's a horror comedy called Zombie versus Ninja. And it's exactly,
I mean,
exactly as advertised. Yeah. I mean, it is that crazy. So I just, you know, I have all these stories and stuff, and some are for books, some are for movies, some are from just, you know, whatever. And I'm just trying to dip my toe into all these little cool instances that I'm afforded access to, you know? So it's like, I'm taking full advantage of all of my fame to be able to do all of the cool things that I've always wanted to do, you know? If I can become a bit part in a Marvel movie, I'm going to use my fame to do so. even if I get kicked off a building, I don't care. Like, that's, if you're not going to use your powers for good, I mean, what's the point, man? You know, it's just, it's ridiculous.
And after all these firsts, we have the last question, which is, what's the last song we should play? What's the song we're going to go out on?
Oh.
What's it going to be?
It's got to be. Listen, I'm gonna drag you back and make you play Looks That Kill, because that's
I knew you were gonna do this.
Of course, man. Come on, dude. That was the first video I ever saw of Motley Crue. It was the first song I heard by Motley Crue, and it made me the crew head that I am to this day.
It's been really good to speak to you, Corey. Thank you very much, man. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, same, man. Pleasure was mine. Thank you.
Motley Crue, four words I don't normally say on Six Music. That was their track, Looks That Kill, and that was the final choice of my guest here on the first time, Corey Taylor from Slipknot. And that is the end of this week's show. If you enjoyed it, you can search The First Time in the BBC Sounds app and listen back to loads more archive episodes. I'll be back next Sunday at the same time talking to super producer Mr. Paul Epworth. Until then, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.
Six.
It's BBC Radio.
Six Music.
Right now.
Let's go.
Six Music's artist in residence. Sole Purpose with Loyal Kana.
If you don't mind, we'd like to play something for you.